Another thing that I heard you mention another time that we haven't really had anyone talk about yet was like Russian Easter and Russian Christmas and so on. Do you remember those celebrations?
Oh yeah, well, I sure do. Yeah. Well, I remember the starring, especially, you know, and I remember people coming around. It was usually like the Serebrennikovs or, you know, and different people like they come around and with the star. And I remember they coming down to our house and Dad would give them all a shot of whiskey, you know, after they start saying, you know, and they have a shot of whiskey and cold, you know, in the middle of winter time. Out they'd go and go someplace else and sing, you know, and do the star. I remember that. And then one year I was old enough to go. They had also had a deal on the in the old well, behind the Linwood, what was it called? The something room? The Blue Room. The Blue Room, yeah. And they had they'd have it had its own private entry from the boardwalk that went out, this long kind of a corridor went out behind the bar, and there's a, you know, built into the dock and so forth, and it was a meeting place and connected to the bar. But they had also, like March of Dimes would have their raffles and all the sort of stuff there. And I remember one year going there, and it was a Russian New Year's, it was on Russian New Year's celebration, and I remember Nick Elexnet was the always, I guess as far back as I could remember, he was always the devil that came around, you know, and stab at you with the pitchfork and everything and scare you off. And then of course there would be the changeover at midnight, and the baby would come out then, and the devil would be chased off, and you know, I remember parts of that. Yeah. And I remember too, like Easter, and all the old people would give the native people would give everybody kalich, you know, and really enjoyed that. All those good old traditions. There was a lot of Russian influence here when I was a kid, and then it was, you know, it was kind of all went away by the time we got into the, I shouldn't say that it went away, but it wasn't as prevalent anyway by the time that we left here in 56. And then when I went to Kodiak and started staying there pretty much throughout the winter after the earthquake and the tidal wave. And I was really surprised to see all those, you know, there was still a really a strong Russian influence over there. So a lot of that stuff. And I married a native girl over there, and so I was pretty much in with the native people there, you know, and went all around the island, and you know, and went to different villages and all that, and just really enjoyed it over there. So, yeah, I lived there for, let's see, from 1966, yeah, 66 until 71 or 72.
So when the earthquake hit, you were down in California?
No, I was out in Adak when it happened, and yeah, we'd been fishing king crab out there, and let's see, how did it go? I was on a boat, was called the Richard D, and it was owned by this Merrill Hennington that used to live here in Seldovia, and he had two boats out there. One of them was the Richard D that I was on with this Turkey George Johnson, fishing with him. And Merrill was had his other boat, the Pacific something, Pacific Fisher, and the Pacific Fisher had had an old Atlas heavy duty slow turning engine in it that it blew up on them before the season got over, and so they couldn't replace the engine or anything. So what the plan was, it was right towards the end of the season, and so what the plan was that they would leave it tied up to the dock there in Adak, in a place called Finger Bay, and then when we got done fishing with the Richard D, then the Richard D would tow the Pacific Fisher to Seattle, and then it changed the engine in it. And so in the meantime, we fished both their gear and our gear. So we had both crews aboard the one boat, and they'd just leave every time we'd come in there. They'd change, but they'd have somebody staying aboard the Pacific Fisher while it was tied to the dock. And so we'd been doing that for, a few days, and then the earthquake. You know, we got the word, oh, there's a big earthquake in Kodiak and blah, 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 and so forth, and, you know, and a tidal wave is coming this way. So we took a bunch of lines and put it on the Pacific Fisher, and everybody jumped aboard the boat, the other boats, and even the processors and everything that were all laying there in Finger Bay. And we all pulled out of the bay and went out into Sweeper Cove, Sitkin Sound, and laid out there until, you know, everybody figured it was all over and done with. And we came back in again, and that there was surges out there that had come up high enough, and there's not much tide out in Adak, but it had come up enough so that all the snow that was on the deck of the docks there was gone, and there was still snow that was on top of the rail caps, so it had just come up and just kind of washed or lapped over that. And so we could tell that the water had come up that high, but the Pacific Fisher was laying there just fine. We had it tied down real well, so it had just rode up and then gone back down again, I guess. So, yeah, that was something. But Merrill used to, how did that go? The house that is Laney Buckman's now was originally owned and built by Torvald Jensen. And Torvald Jensen and his wife Martha had a trap up on Nikiski.
Fish trap, salmon trap.
Yeah, big driven salmon trap. He had, and he almost, I think all of the other driven traps in Cook Inlet, anyway, were all owned by canneries. And for some reason, I don't know what the deal was, but he owned this trap himself. And it was really a big producer, did real well. I said Nikiski, but I meant Starisky. And I remember when Dad had this Seabee in the summertime when the weather was really nice, we'd fly up there out of Seldovia and fly up to Starisky, and he'd land on the beach with that amphibian, and we'd get out, and Mom and myself and my sister would stay there for, I don't know if my sister was born then or not, I don't remember. But we'd go up there and stay with them for 2 or 3 or 4 days, and God, the fish that they used to catch up there in that trap, it was really something. But anyway, I remember one year, they made so much money, they just couldn't stand it. So they went out to Seattle, and they bought themselves a brand-new home for $40,000, and they bought themselves a brand-new Buick for $1,500. And then after that, they never did come back to Seldovia again, because by 59 is when the traps went, you know. I know what they did, yeah. They lost all their money. And Martha was originally from Ninilchik, came from a big Ninilchik family. And so they moved back up to Ninilchik, and Torvald used to make the best smoked salmon you could ever imagine. It was just wonderful stuff. So he kept doing that up there. They moved, they had a little cabin that they, I don't know if they built it or they just got it from somebody on, what they call Deep Creek, down there in the flats of Deep Creek. And he'd buy king salmon and smoke king salmon there and you know, just did quite well for themselves. I mean, living a very simple life, you know, but they got along just fine. And then the last time I saw Torvald, I think, was in 1971, maybe, 70 or 71. And I saw him and Martha there, and I gave them a ride down to their place. They were up. I'd stopped into the restaurant, bar, liquor store there, and they were there. And I took him down to their place, drove them down to his place, and that's the last time I saw him. But he was really sick then. He had lung cancer real bad, and it had eaten away his, even eaten away his bones, you know, his ribs and so forth. And But he passed away soon after that. But he was still out and going up and having a drink, you know. Unbelievable.
Old that was guy. In Nanilchik?
That was in Nanilchik, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, kind of circling back to your dad, you talked about his spying career here, but then how did he make the transition to being a police officer?
So, you know, I think it was 1951, 50 or 51 was the last year he flew. And as I was saying, what happened as far as the flying is concerned is Alaska Airlines came in and cut him down to the point that they couldn't even do any business anymore. And then soon after that, they decided to sell the airplane. And Dad was working for Al Villa. He became Al Villa's Alaska Shellfish Company down there, which originally was a shrimp plant. And then it changed over to a salmon plant. But Dad was his, canloff foreman. And he did that. And then that fall, he started as a cop, I think. Yeah, it was August or September. He became the chief of police of Seldovia, you know. And Mom worked at the store, and Dad got... Mom worked at the store and she made about $250 a month in those days, and Dad made $350 being the cop. And then he also was a winter watchman at the first year. First year was at AYR, Alaska Year-Round Canneries, and superintendent's house was right on the premises there. And so we lived there so he could be the watchman there that winter. And we stayed there that year. And he was that watchman for a couple of years. And he got $500 for the winter to be the watchman. But then we got to eat all the food that was left over in the commissary. And then he made money by shoveling snow, you know, shovel snow. So, you know, got along okay. Everything was fine. And, I mean, Dad... Flying was really important to Dad. He just loved to fly, but he just did not want to leave Seldovia. My dad wasn't the kind of guy that was, all he wanted to do was get along, you know. He didn't have any great ambitions or anything, and when the flying thing wasn't working out financially for him, you know, you would have thought maybe that he would have gone someplace else and looked for, so he could stay in the flying business, but he decided he didn't want to leave Seldovia, I guess, so it must have meant a lot to him.
And so did he have any training to become a police officer?
No, none at all. I can remember so well him getting his equipment. It was funny, because I don't know where he got it, but he had a club, a sap, I guess you'd call it. It was a great big long leather thing with a big heavy ball on the end of, well, it wasn't that big, but a little lead, you know, and this wrapped up in this thing, and it had been laying around the house there for years, and I don't know where he got it. It was long before he was a cop. I think he'd gotten it someplace just so if somebody gave him a problem in the airplane, he'd knock him over the head or something to calm him down. But I remember he had that, and then he got a sap. He wouldn't carry a gun. He would not carry a gun. He said, I don't want to shoot anybody, you know. And then they got him this little gas gun. And it was like a gas pen. It was a little pen, and it had this little, actions in it so you could shoot this gas out. And kind of like one of the things they got for scaring bear off or something nowadays.
Like a little tear gas.
It was just a little tear gas thing is what it was. And that one year after he was the cop, and he was, we were staying, well, let's see, the first winter we stayed at home. And the second winter, we decided to move down to the AYR cannery and live there. But that year that we stayed at home, we had these old Celotex ceilings, which made out of the same kind of stuff as like this, you know, but it was big full sheets. And for sound deadening and warmth, you know. But the squirrels got up in our attic. And my sister and I shared the same bedroom. She's 7 years younger than me. But I slept in the top bunk. And I remember that we could hear those things up there, scratch, 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 you know, and they'd be in the walls. They'd work their way up the walls, and they were all over the house. And so I remember early one morning I woke up, and there was something falling in my face, and I looked up, and here's this squirrel looking down through the Celotex at me, you know, and Dad says, that's it, we got to get rid of those things. So we all moved down to AYR, down to the other place, and he took that gas gun of his and went up there and shot it up into the ceiling and everything, and of course made the whole house something terrible, but nobody was living in it then anyway. So he got them all driven out. He got rid of them, and then where they'd gotten into the walls, there was no fire blocking in the walls. There's a built old tinderbox house, you know, and they were able to get in under the bottom part of the sheeting and go right up the 2x4s up to the top. That's how they got up there, I guess. But that's how he cleaned them out, is with that gas gun. But, like I say, we've got some books there. I'll have to show them to you there, that little things he carried around in his pocket, different problems he'd run across and everything. So it was pretty interesting.
And he was the only police officer, or did he have
He was the only one, but Seldovia, things were a lot different in those days, you know. In the first place, yeah, he was the only one. There was no deputy or anything like that. But what he would do, and so this is before the days of area fishing, and so what would happen is that all these guys from, at 4th of July, just before 4th of July, all these guys would show up from both the Columbia River Gang, they call them the Columbia River Gang. There was a contingent of them that would put their boats on Alaska Steamship and they'd haul them up to Cordova, and they'd fish Cordova and Copper River Flats and so forth first, and then they'd run their boats from there over to Seldovia, and then they'd be here for the 4th of July, and then they'd fish out here. And some of them, though, some of them did go on, instead of stopping here, from the other areas and go to Bristol Bay. They'd haul them over on the highway, well, on the road, you know, from Lake Iliamna, or over to Lake Iliamna and down. But the ones that would come in here, I remember when I was a kid, I remember those guys coming in from Cordova, and, I mean, hundreds of boats. And the harbor would, I mean, we didn't have a boat harbor in those days. There was just the float one out there. But they'd come in at, like, I remember one time they come in at high tide, and it was the middle of the night, you know, or real early daylight, early in the morning. But they came in and actually tied up to the boardwalk, you know, like along in front of the Polar Bar and different places like that. And they all went dry, and boats were laying this way and this way and all over, you know, everybody. But just a really something. But they'd come to town. And especially these Columbia River boys, they were really a bad bunch. And they just figure, you know, they're big, all well over 6 feet, all of those guys. And I think there was six or eight of them. And they'd come to town, they just figure the town's theirs, they're going to take over, you know, and they'd just do whatever they want. And Dad, in those days, we didn't have regular telephones. They had the old, like, the cop's phone was a short and a long. And, you know, you'd ring the thing like that. And so Dad would get this short and long. Of course, everybody, as soon as everybody heard their short and long, everybody you hear click, 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 people all over trying to.
So we're continuing with Mike Miller, and you were talking about the Columbia River Gang.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of take over the town and what your dad would have to do.
Right. And so what he'd do in those days when they were sort of causing problem, he'd just go down to the Linwood or Surf Club or Polar Bar or whichever one they weren't raising all the hell in, and he'd go over and say, hey, I deputize you and locals, you know. And so the whole bunch of them would get together and they'd go down there take, you know, throw them in jail or do whatever, and that's the way they did it. And when my dad was first the cop, the jail consisted of a little white shack, clapboard shack that was up on the hill right across from where the power plant is. And there it was just a little white building with a sloped roof, and it had a Celotex ceiling, and it had a like a shed roof off the back of it, like a Calidor. And so when they throw somebody in jail there, you know, most of them were drunk and they just pass out and sleep it off or whatever, and they'd get up. And I remember there was a hatch in the ceiling. And if they wanted to get out, they'd just go up to the hatch in the ceiling, and then it had another little trap door in the back over the top of the shed roof, and they'd knock that open and go out and go back downtown again, you know. Oh, boy, it was something else. And then, of course, they finally built the new jail out of block, and then they had a big steel door, and they could hold him in there, but he'd get so exasperated. And they not only did they, that was the jail, but they also used it for the morgue. Somebody died, they'd take him in there and lay him down. I remember his kids, you know, staring in there and seeing somebody's hair sticking up out of there. But, yeah, so Dad would go down and he'd round up a bunch of people and they'd go and make them go to jail or shut up or slow down or go back to the boat or whatever, you know. And I know one time he went to confront them himself for some reason first, I guess. And this one guy, one of the Columbia River boys, Dad had that sap in his hand. And the guy grabbed him, or maybe one of them came up from behind him, I'm not sure. But one of them grabbed him and actually broke the strap off of his wrist and hit him over the head with it. And then all the local guys all piled in and tore him off and saved Dad, you know, from his problem there. That was a tough one. But that's what they did. And then they had these, you know, they called it getting a blue ticket out of town, too. That was the other thing. If somebody raised too much hell around here, well, then the city of Seldovia would put them on an airplane and send them out of here with the instructions, don't come back, we don't need you here. And then what was the other one that they, if somebody drank too much, if drinking was a real problem, like if they had family and they wouldn't take care of their family and they spent all their money drinking, what did they used to call that? One was a blue ticket on town, the other one, 96th or 86th, 86th they call it. Yeah, you're 86th, that means you've, you can't have a drink in town. You can't buy a drink. You can't do anything. So,
so it was town cooperation, in other words, was pretty important for.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Something. Yeah, those were some of the highlights that I remember, anyway. Yes. Huh.
That sounds like an awfully challenging job. Did he enjoy being a police officer?
No, he hated it. Yeah. My dad was one of the best liked guys when he was a pilot, you know. He was just everybody's friend and everybody's buddy and got along, and he was always laughing and happy, and he got to be the cop, and immediately 50% of the people hated his guts, and it just really bothered him, because it was important for him to be liked, you know, as an individual. And I remember he'd come home and he'd just tell Mom, you know, about, oh, God, I hate this. I just hate this job. But I have to make a living some way, so. Mm-hmm. And then he got throat cancer, and he worked. We didn't know he had cancer, but that spring, his throat started bothering him, a sore throat. But it was just before the busy part of the year, and so he continued to work down in the cannery and be the cop all summer long. And then as soon as the season was over, he and I'd been gone fishing, and I remember I made $924. And so I had money, and Dad got his paycheck, and he and I flew up to Anchorage with Bob Gruber, and we went to the Anchorage Hotel, which is attached to the Westward Hotel, or I don't know what they call it now. I think it's still the Anchorage Westward. But we got a room in there, and our doctor at that time was old Doc Romig, Howard Romig, and he was a good friend of Dad's. Dad and Doc Romig used to hunt together, do all sorts of things together. But anyway, we got up there that time, and Dad said, I had my check, and he had his check. Mine was for $900 and some dollars, and his was for $3,000 something. And he says, now, he says, I want you to go across the street. I was 14 years old. And he said, I want you to go across the street over there to the Bank of America, NBA, NB of A, their main office. I think their only office for an Anchorage in those days was there on 4th Avenue. And he says, go over there, take these checks over there, and go ask for, what's the name of the president of the bank there? What made me? Rasmussen, Elmer Rasmussen. He said, now go over there and just ask somebody for Elmer Rasmussen. And I said, okay. So I stood in line scared and everything, and I got up to the teller, and I says, my dad told me I have to see Elmer Rasmussen. And Elmer Rasmussen, there was a back of the, opposite from the entry door on the back wall, there was an office back there, held a glass, and the door was open, you know, like the old bankers always did, you know, and you always have to leave the door open. And so she said, let me help you. And so she walked me over there, and she said, Mr. Rasmussen, and he said, yes. And he says, well, I was a young man to see you. And so, yeah, I was ushered in there and said, what can I do for you, young man? And I says, well, my dad told me to come over and see you and get these checks cashed. And he said, oh, who's your dad? And I says, Dick Miller. Oh, Dick Miller from Seldovia, lives in Seldovia? And I said, oh, yeah, fine. He said, what do you got there? So anyway, he cashed the checks and, you know, put them in a couple of envelopes and so forth. And he says, where's your dad now? And I said, well, he's over in the hotel over here. And he says, well, why isn't he over? I said, oh, he's awful sick. He's got a real bad sore throat. Okay, he says, I'll go over with you. So we went across the street, and he went up, and, hey, Dick, you know, and how you doing? And they talked, and Dad couldn't really talk. It was so messed up. But always remember that, you know, Elmer Rasmussen. And, you know, he was quite a man. How many millions and millions of dollars that he's donated to Alaska's people, you know, or something. But he was... That was something to know someone like that. I mean, meet somebody like that and under those circumstances. So anyway, from there, I went and got my summer or my winter clothes at Army-Navy store. That was on 4th Avenue back in those days. And went and got all my clothes there. And Dad flew outside. He saw Dr. Romig. And Dr. Romig says, no, he says, you better go outside. And so he went out to Virginia Mason in Seattle. And I went home. Then we found that he had cancer and went all downhill from there, you know. But and then I was going to say he came back up again in, what month did he came back up in December. Yeah, back in December. And he said he was going to have to go back down again, but he came home for the holidays and needed money. So he saw Jack English, who was the magistrate, and said, you know, so Jack says, well, yeah, I can put you back to work as cop. They didn't have anybody a cop at the time for some reason. So Dad went back to work, and he went downtown one night on his rounds, he called. He just walked around town. In the summertime, he rode a bicycle. But he went down to one of the bars, and a local guy down there, I'm not going to mention any names, but was raising all sorts of hell. And so Dad says, hey, you know, you got to take it easy. And the guy gave him all sorts of hell, so Dad was going to throw him in jail. So they went outside and started walking him up to the jail, and the guy told him, he says, you think you're something else, and you take that badge off, and I'll show you what for or whatever. The old man, he took his badge off, and they got in a fight. And the guy grabbed him by his throat and just about killed the old man, you know. And so, I mean, to this day, I don't know if that had anything to do with it or not. But, I mean, we had no idea that he was terminal, that he was going to go. And then when he went back down again, he never came back. So that was a tough one to take. Yeah.
Well, I guess I don't want to keep you too much longer. But
no.
Obviously, you came back to Seldovia and decided to raise kids here.
Oh, yeah.
What brought you back? What made you want to come back here?
I don't know, really. I just came back, and I just felt so at home here and felt so good to be back and to see all the people that I knew, you know. And, of course, there's a lot of new people in, too. But I just felt so much at home and started fishing out of here, and our house became available for sale over here, and you know, I bought it, and we just stayed. You know, I was married to Pam at the time, and we were here for until, let's see, from I came back in 75. I bought the place in September of 75, and she and I were only together until 78 or 79, and then so her folks lived up in Anchorage, and her dad was retiring, and they wanted to move out to Puyallup, Washington, and they wanted to sell their house up there, and that was really during a tough time for real estate up in Anchorage. You know, things weren't moving very much, and so we decided to buy their place, and I was going to move up there too, but then we got, I don't know what happened, and our lives got separated, and so she took the kids and went up there, and I stayed down here, and the kids came down and stayed with me every time they could, and so forth, and we worked everything out, and that's, you know. And it's kind of really surprised. Pardon?
That's the house you're in now?
Yeah. What's really surprised to me, though, is the girls, you know, that they've actually decided that they want to live here. Yeah, Seldovia wouldn't be the same for me if it wasn't for them, that's for sure. But I think I'd still have a hard time leaving. Mm-hmm. I really would. I mean,
you've got grandsons here, too.
Yeah. And hopefully life will be good for them. I would like to be able to pass on my fishing holdings and so forth to them sometime, but we just don't know if there's going to be anything worth anything by the time they get old enough to fish it. So.
Right.
Hard to say. But.
Mm-hmm. Well, anything that I should have asked you about that I didn't that you could think
of? Well, not that I can think of at this mm-hmm. point. I kind of running out of steam.
We've been talking a long time for you, which I really appreciate. This has been a wonderful discussion.
I hope I didn't jump around too much.
Oh, no.